Hey everybody, I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode number 137. It'll be up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. It'll be on YouTube. It'll be on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com. It'll be on libertarianinstitute.org. If you use libertarianinstitute.org/Mance, it'll be right there. I want to remind you that I wrote two books, Freedom Through Memedom, The Kids Are Not All Right. Check them out on Amazon. They're also available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. And there you can get them only for cryptocurrency. Today, I am welcoming Neil Franklin to the show. Neil used to be a police officer. He was a police officer for 34 years. And he is advocating that Ross Ulbricht be released immediately. When Neil learned about the case and he learned about the corruption behind the scenes, especially the corruption of the investigating officers, he immediately knew something was wrong, and he is speaking out about it. So I ask him questions about Ross's case, and then we actually get into some questions about policing in general. I think this is a great talk, and I think you're going to love it. So without any further delay, here's a recording of my conversation with Neil Franklin. I'm here with Mr. Neil Franklin. How are you doing today, Mr. Franklin?
I am well. Thanks for having me on today.
Thank you for coming on. I asked you to come on so that we could talk about the Ross Ulbricht case. But before we get into that, I want everybody to know your credentials, because you were in law enforcement for a long time. So talk a little bit about what you've accomplished and where you're at right now.
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. So I started in policing back in the late 1970s and had a total of 34 years in policing in the state of Maryland. I began with Maryland State Police. And soon after graduating from the police academy in the late 70s there, literally a year and a half on the road, and I ended up going into undercover work. So undercover narcotics investigations in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. And I did that for a while, but one of the things that I noticed rather quickly is that most of the arrests that we were making by far were for low-level marijuana possession arrests. But that's a whole nother story. So I eventually ended up getting promoted, moving up through the ranks, became a lieutenant, eventually commanding 7 multi-jurisdictional drug task forces in the western part of the state. Then later in my career, becoming a captain, then major, I had the Northeast region for the Bureau of Drug and Criminal Enforcement. So I had 9 drug task forces and 5 criminal task forces for the state of Maryland. And my last 2 years with the Maryland State Police, I was the head of training, retired there in 99 and went to work for Baltimore City. I was recruited to take their training division through a reformation. So I stayed with them for 4 years and then went on to my last police agency, Maryland Transit, for 6 years, where I was the head of the Detective Bureau before moving over to Chief of Patrol. And that's the only reason I gave up policing was to become the executive director of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, LEAP, and, you know, to focus on a broad range of criminal justice issues, mainly centered around the failed drug war policies, because these failed policies literally dovetail and interact with just about every facet of our lives. And regarding our criminal justice system, if something is wrong within our criminal justice system, you can almost be certain that the failed war on drugs is closely behind, has something to do with it. So I've been the executive director of LEAP now for 8 years. And what we do is we focus on a broad range of criminal justice issues. We're a nonprofit, we're international. Most of our work is in the United States, but we cover 5 basic areas: drug policy, police community relations, harm reduction, incarceration, and global issues. And we do that by way of a very talented and expert speakers bureau made up of police officers, judges, prosecutors, corrections officials, and federal agents, and more. That's it in a nutshell. And I have found myself a few years ago doing some work regarding Ross's case.
The Ross case is interesting. Everything that you bring up, you know, I've from everything I've studied of the war on drugs, it's just like prohibition, in the 20s. When prohibition came along, violent crime went up. Violence against police officers went up. They do away with prohibition. Now this starts to go down, and you start to see violent crime go down, police officer injury and death go down. Fast forward to the 70s, and Nixon decides there's going to be a war on drugs. The establishment runs with it, and now we start seeing violence in the street going up again, and we start seeing police officers in harm's way, but not only in harm's way, but becoming more militarized and seeing what looked like soldiers in Afghanistan, and in many cases even more well equipped, on the streets of America. Now, when you look at Ross's case, he always said that he made statements that he was trying to build a marketplace where violence, like the, where you could reduce violence for people who want to interact, and even with drugs. So when you see someone making a statement like that, what are your basic thoughts on what he did, what he created?
Well, first of all, I agree 100% with what you said about the failed war on drugs, and you kind of related that to alcohol prohibition of the 1920s and early 30s. And you're absolutely right. When you have an illicit market like that, along with it comes tremendous violence that we saw back in the 1920s with alcohol prohibition, and we repeated that very same mistake with drugs, certain drugs, here, in today's time. And what Ross did literally did take the violence out of the marketplace. Let me give an example. I'm in Baltimore. I grew up in Baltimore, policed in Baltimore, and I currently live in Baltimore. The violence in Baltimore that we are experiencing, and the violence that we see in Chicago and other cities alike, is directly related to a direct result of these prohibition drug policies, where the marketplace is on our street corners. The significance of that is that when you have people selling drugs on street corners, and where they cannot be protected by the law because it's illegal, when someone robs them, they cannot report it. So when someone robs them of their drugs and cash, they cannot report it to the police. They can't even have a legal means of deciding what territory we're going to operate in because it's illegal. What that means is that I have to fend for myself. As someone selling drugs on a street corner, I have to arm myself. Guns quickly become tools of the trade. If you encroach upon my real estate, my corner, I have to show force in order to keep that corner, that real estate. And here's something else that people don't know. We, the police, in enforcing these laws actually help to create violence. Because when we go into a neighborhood, as we're charged with doing, and we take down the neighborhood crew that's selling drugs on three or four corners, we then create a void. Open real estate, valuable real estate, valuable corners, and then the remaining drug crews and gangs fight for those empty corners. And then once you have one shooting and someone gets shot, then you have retaliation among those gangs and crews for months, sometimes years. So tremendous violence follows that street corner neighborhood drug dealing market. Now what Ross did, he took it off of the street corners. Not only did he just take it off of the street corners and therefore removing the violence from the marketplace, but he did something else that's uniquely different. Along with the illicit marketplace comes no quality control for the drugs that are being sold, meaning that, you don't know what you're getting. There are no references. There's no way of kind of like ensuring that you're getting a relatively decent product. You're just taking a chance every time you do it. That's the main reason we're dealing with fentanyl-laced products today. On the internet, as Ross did, he took it from, he took it to the internet. And what happens when you do that? You then create a marketplace where you have referrals. You can go and see information about that person's product from other users. And either it's going to be good information or it's going to be not so good information. Then you can decide whether or not you want to purchase. And this is where this is similar to shopping on Amazon.com or any of the other online marketplaces. You look at the referrals, which are an important part to whether or not you make a decision to buy from them or not. That's what he did. So he also improved quality control of the products being sold, in addition to removing the violence from the marketplace. The marketplace is not going anywhere. For us, it's just a matter of what type of marketplace are we going to see, what type of marketplace are we going to advocate for in our communities. And that should be the safest marketplace available.
Now, so Ross sets up the site, so it gets up and going. From what I understand, the people would try to put stuff up there that they didn't want on there. They'd take it down as soon as possible. Basically, from what I understand, for the majority of the time, basically it was small amounts of marijuana were being sold and some like designer drugs or something like that that I've heard people had bought off of it. And as an aside, I had somebody, I was advocating for Ross on Twitter, and I had somebody said, do you know how many, you know, thousands of people he was responsible for killing? And I just threw it out there and I said, from what I understand, and this really can't even be proven, they said that drugs that came off of the site, that they could possibly attribute 6 deaths to it. But that's not it. And I asked this person, I said, even if it is 6, how many people in the last 2 hours have died from prescription opioids? And they don't want to hear, they don't want to hear that. All they don't want to hear that they're the good little government, you know, did this. It is basically because of the way the healthcare system is set up, and not having marijuana, one of the greatest pain relievers in the world, legal, that they could, you know, that people are dying every single day. You know, I've read reports of up to 100 people are dying from opioids every day, and from prescription opioids too. So, you know, if say it was 6, you know, 6 people, and say that is true, I mean, how it seems to me that he was doing a hell of a lot better than the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a very good place to be right now in this conversation, because right now, as we talk, people are dying from ingesting peanuts. My point is this. People are going to find what they believe they want, and they're going to use it for whatever their reason for using, whether they're addicted to the substance or whether, you know, they just want to change their state of mind, state of consciousness for a while. People are going to do that. People have been doing that as far back as history goes, whether it's just through a basic plant mushroom that they're consuming, or whether it's through some sort of, you know, chemical concoction, you know, that does something similar. People are going to do that. Again, as I said before, the market's not going to go anywhere. It's just a matter of how do we create the safest possible market? You know, for the people who did, you know, leave the marketplace of buying drugs on the street corners, for the people who did leave that market to go to the market that Ross set up, I guarantee you that lives, many lives were saved. Again, because of the quality control that comes with that. And again, the references that are there, you have more of an idea of what you're purchasing. You know, do I agree 100% with what Ross did? No, I don't. But I can tell you this, he did create a safer marketplace of what's currently available for these substances. You know, in my mind, what he had done is pretty much said that, look, we can have safer marketplaces. If the government really, you know, if they were really about saving lives, if they were really about making safer communities, and which means safer products, whatever those products are, whether it's alcohol, you know, whether it's tobacco products, it's all about harm reduction for something that we know exists. Cars, and I know this is oranges and apples kind of thing, but cars kill people. What do we do every day? We find a way to make safer cars, because we know cars are going to be here. So how do we make safer cars? You know, how do we increase the safety of that environment. Same thing with alcohol. Alcohol is a drug. Alcohol kills a lot of people from consumption. But what do? We put regulations in place, age, time, use, place restrictions in place, but we still make it reasonable so people can get what they want, know what they're getting, and then use it as safely as possible. And we're always adjusting, always adjusting. We should be doing the same thing with these other drugs that we know people are buying and that people are going to use. And on the other end of that, for those people who have problematic drug use, because that's just a small percentage of the people who use drugs, for those people who have that problematic drug use, let's deal with the mental health issues that they're dealing with. Let's dig down to the foundation, the core of why they continue to use in a problematic way. That's how you make a safer environment for the lives of people.
Now, from what you know of Ross's case, when did he first come on the radar of, do you know when he first came on the radar of law enforcement?
Oh, wow. I do not, but he came on my radar after he had been arrested and charged, which has been a couple of years now. But I don't know when that initial point was, because that would be in the onset of their investigation. I don't know if anybody really knows, because there were so many problems with Ross's case, with the people actually conducting the investigations, and along with some criminality on some of their parts. So you really have no idea exactly what they were doing.
Well, let's get into that. Okay, so Ross is arrested, and all this evidence is brought forward. I'll jump forward to the bail hearing. He has all these charges, and at that time they had the murder for hire charge in there.
Right.
So they get bail denied. 2 months later, they drop the murder for hire, and just without prejudice, and just recently, within the last week and a half, that was finally dismissed with prejudice.
Yes, so the District of Maryland, I think it was. Yep, that was dismissed.
And so you mentioned corruption within the case. And now I've read from, and talking to Lynn, that the whole time that Ross is they're preparing him for trial, and he's going on trial, and he's on trial, investigators whose evidence they're using in this case are being brought up on their own charges. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, I don't know the details, but I know there was thefts of currency. I believe it was a Bitcoin by at least one of the investigators. And I know there were some problems, with some others. And my point is this. So we have people involved deeply in the investigation, which led to the charging of Ross. And these people, it is now, as you said, are brought up on charges. These federal investigators are brought up on charges. How can you trust any part of their testimony, which includes any evidence that may have been gathered? We see cases like this all across the country. Baltimore, unfortunately, the Baltimore Police Department is having significant problems in this area, where you have distrust, lying, fabricating police officers. And then what happens, all the cases that they have been involved in, not just what they were currently investigating, but even convictions of the past, where people have claimed that, hey, I didn't do these things. These cases are now being, getting a second look, and many of them are being dropped and dismissed. Because when you have, agents of the state who are corrupt and crooked, you can't trust anything that they're currently working on or anything that they've done in the past. And unfortunately, and maybe fortunately, you have to, in most of those cases that they were involved in, dismiss them or go back and take another look at them. And maybe some people were actually innocent.
Where Ross is at right now, I believe that he's exhausted all his appeals. I mean, the way the system works, you can only do so much to appeal. it sounds to me like you would advocate for everything would have to be dismissed, and if they want to retry it, they can. Does that make sense, right?
I would. And let me tell you something. Again, at the beginning of our conversation here, again, 34 years in policing, at all levels of policing, working criminal investigation, narcotics, involved in many high-profile cases, and so on. I am not naive to this. I understand the significance, you know, of such an investigation. But again, you know, and comparing Ross's situation, where we're talking about corrupt investigators, comparing his situation, you know, to people who have done heinous things, you know, who have preyed upon our children, pedophiles and rapists and others, you know, do far less time than what Ross has already done. You know, and I think this case is more about the federal government, or maybe people within the federal government, trying to make some sort of statement or set some sort of example, you know, through the injustices that are occurring here with Ross in his case. And it's not fair. It's not something that should be done. You know, treat him fairly, you know, not just in what he has been charged with. And as you mentioned, what has been dismissed regarding this crazy murder for hire stuff, where there was never any evidence of, but treat him fairly, you know, for what he has been charged with, you know, regarding this, you know, quote unquote online service, and really take a good look at it. But take a good look at it after you've educated yourself, you know, regarding the totality of his case and this type of online marketplace. Yeah, I would definitely advocate, you know, to end this for Ross right now, and to let this young man return home to his family and stop trying to set some morbid example of what he's done.
Can you speak to what the judge did in rebringing up the murder for hire charge in sentencing?
Well, yeah. In my opinion, that was absolutely improper in doing that, because we're talking about a charge. A conviction would be something different, you know, but again, this is a country where you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And he should never have introduced anything relative to a charge absent a conviction. And, you know, so in my opinion, it's absolutely improper. It shouldn't have been done. And, you know, we also need to get to a place where we start reprimanding judges. Judges, we've given them way too much latitude. And when they say things they shouldn't say or do things they shouldn't do, we should be very quick to and have some sort of process of remedy for holding them accountable for the things that they say. That was that was very detrimental to Ross, and again, absolutely improper.
Can you speak to he was charged with Kingpin, which is something that I remember reading the story, and I'm blanking on the gentleman's name, in New Jersey, who was charged with a kingpin charge in 1991. And it turned out that he was completely innocent and, you know, got life without parole, and ended up educating himself so much, and through appeals, he got out. And then he turned around and became a lawyer, and he sued the judges and the prosecutors and everything, got them thrown in jail. But this kingpin charge, yeah, I don't know if you knew that story. I love it. Yeah, one of the prosecutors actually fled to Las Vegas, and he was in a hotel. And when they showed up to arrest him, he put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger. So, and they basically destroyed this guy's life. It was a gigantic conspiracy. But this kingpin charge, what do you know about this? That it's just that it sounds like something out of a movie that you would make up for a movie. But apparently, it comes with guaranteed, if you're convicted of it, guaranteed life, no parole.
Yeah. So we came about and instituted and developed this kingpin charge, for drug dealing and distribution and manufacturing. So back in the 1980s, you know, and it's all, as with a lot of what we do regarding our criminal justice system, was politically motivated. It's how can I, as a politician, which are also many of our prosecutors, depending upon which state you're in, how can I, as a politician, you know, appear to be tough on crime? You know, how can I sell this rhetoric? You know, and what do I do? Okay, let's adopt this kingpin charge and show that we're serious about the war on drugs, and we're going to go after these people who are, you know, bringing all this mayhem and whatever into our communities and this, that, and the other. Again, totally ignoring the fact that it's the policies of drug prohibition that have got us into this very difficult place and problematic place in the first place. So we come up with these kingpin charges with these life without parole sentences, and then it looks good, it sounds good, it feels good. And once you start down the road of prosecuting someone for such a charge, even if and when you recognize that, whoa, this isn't what we should be doing for this particular case, or we've made a mistake, or this evidence is tainted, or these police officers that were involved in gathering this evidence were corrupt. And reason after reason after reason, for some reason, and again, it's political, we have a problem with saying, time out, stop, this isn't appropriate, let's drop it, let's dismiss it. Because then they feel as though they're going to appear weak and they won't win their next election. Because you ask any politician, what are the two most important things, you know, for them? The first one is getting elected, and number two is getting reelected. And anything that they have to do to make that happen, they will, even at the expense of our citizens who are being charged and prosecuted improperly and sometimes illegally from coast to coast across this country.
So just to, I want to speak a little more about, ask you a couple more questions about policing in general, but just to wrap up the Ross case, it's your opinion as a 34 years in law enforcement, from everything you've seen, the corruption of the agents, basically everything surrounding this case, that there's no way that even if they did get a conviction, once all of this other stuff came to light, basically everything should have been overturned, that he should have been released from jail.
Absolutely. At the very least, time served. But again, with everything that's involved, as you mentioned, you know, the corruption and everything else, the charges, the situation itself, you know, yes, should have been released. And that's one of the reasons that I actually signed on to the amicus brief, you know, to free Ross. I believe it that strongly. This is a case of injustice, as we continue to see case after case after case of injustice, you know, in this country, on the foundation, the failed, broken foundation of the war on drugs.
Okay. Tomorrow, here's a scenario. Tomorrow, marijuana is legalized throughout the land. War on drugs is scaled back. You know, we basically have a miracle. What do you, I mean, it really isn't a miracle. I mean, enough states are legalizing and decriminalizing that, I mean, we're going to see, we'll see it probably soon, right?
Yes, we will. I think, put it this way, when I started this work about a decade ago, I never thought that I would see it in my lifetime for marijuana being a regulated marketplace across this country and legal. But now I know that I will, early and before the end of my lifetime. But then we still have to work on these other things, other drugs, opiates, you know, cocaine, meth, and the likes. And I know some of the listeners are probably going, what problem we're having with opium right now? You want to regulate and control that? Yeah, I know that's another show, but all you got to do is look at my work, look at my writings, and how I explain it and talk about it, and take a look at what we're doing in some other countries, and I think you'll get it rather quickly. We just need to pay attention, more attention to mental health and the issue of addiction itself. But yes, marijuana, that's done. It's just a matter of it, you know, filtering into the rest of the states, and thank goodness.
Yeah. Well, the listeners of this show, if you start talking about legalizing everything, you're going to make a lot of friends, actually. Because I saw what happened in Portugal, and I think that's a fine example of
it really is. I'm hoping that we can move forward rather quickly with psychedelics too, because let me tell you something. Because of the restrictions placed on us by the government regarding psychedelics, we're missing the boat of being able to help so many people from a medicinal perspective as it relates to some mental health issues such as PTSD for our veterans and others. And we have no idea just how far, you know, we can go in using psychedelics to improve the lives of people. So, you know, hopefully that'll move quickly.
I see you've been reading the same reports I have. So.
Let me tell you something. This is one of the problems of policing, is that policing has isolated itself for the most part, not everyone, but a large swath of law enforcement folks have isolated themselves from the community and therefore isolated themselves from increased learning, you know, about these things that they are charged with enforcing, these laws that they're charged with enforcing. We have isolated ourselves from history. We have isolated ourselves from, you know, the truth regarding use, regarding abuse of these drugs. And we have put ourselves in very awkward positions of not learning things that we should know. And thank God I'm not there anymore. And I've read a lot of the same reports that you have.
Okay. So going back to my scenario of getting legalization, decriminalization, the town over for me, I live in the northern part of Atlanta. One town over is a town of 10,000 people, and they have a tank. They have a tank to help them fight in the drug war. Now, say this drug war, you know, all the violence that's surrounding it, I mean, there'll always be some kind of black market, this and that and everything, but the violence drastically goes down.
Mm-hmm.
How, knowing police officers like you do, would they welcome this, or, and I don't want this to sound the way it's going to sound, or would they see this as a threat to their job, like job security?
Okay. So in my response here, let me just say that I'm not speaking about all police officers. There are a number of police officers out there who get this, maybe not to the extent that I do, but they understand that we should not be a militarized force within our communities. They understand that the militarization that you currently see, whether it's a tank or whether it's the militaristic style clothing that police officers are now wearing, they understand that the onset of that is not the war on terror. It began with the war on drugs back in the early 1980s when we started getting surplus equipment from the military. It wasn't as high tech and in your face as it is today. But the problem we would see going forward is that, you know, boys don't like to part with their toys. You know, a lot of this, having the tanks and the MRAPs and everything, the militarized equipment, and even that look, you know, it's like an adrenaline rush to have and to use this stuff. And, you know, unfortunately, we have police leaders that compare their equipment to the neighboring police officers, police department's equipment, you know, and one police department gets something and, well, you know, it's keeping up with the Joneses. I got to have mine too. And when you have it, you know what? You use it. Now, don't get me wrong. There is a need for having protective gear. There is a need for having even an MRAP available, not at the numbers we have them, but there is a need for having them because we do have people who like to shoot multiple people in schools. They like to shoot from elevated positions. Just look at Las Vegas just a few months ago, right? And when you need to get people out of the line of fire, believe me, that's something you want. But they shouldn't be in parades. They shouldn't be out in the open. Every time you turn around, they need to be in a garage. They need to be undercover. And then when you need it, then it's available for use. But you use it for the right issue.
I wrote an article about a year ago saying that, making the argument that police should be like the fire department, that they should remain in their precincts, or you could have multiple precincts in a neighborhood. And a good start would be, basically just like firemen don't go around looking for fires. They wait to be called. And considering police response times are, pretty horrible, and then, I know police officers don't like to talk about the case, the many cases where it's been determined that police do not have a responsibility to protect individuals. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the main one right now, and I wrote about it in a book. But I made that argument. And what's funny is, when I tell people about that, even regular people, they're just like, yeah, that actually does make sense when you take everything into consideration. But I see down here, especially, most of the police presence that I see is just basically revenue generating, is pulling people over, writing summonses, things like that. And my two things about policing have always been that, stop with the nickel and diming. And I don't believe that there should be somebody in society that have rights that I don't.
Yeah. I think that's important what you just said, and that's something that we need to continue to explore, because public safety is first and foremost a community responsibility, not that of the police. But in order for a community to do a really good job at public safety, the community needs to be healthy. And, and that means that, family units need to be healthy, households, and it means that they need to be free of things that are problematic for them to thrive, such as, you need health care, you need education, you need food, nutrition, you need those basic things of survival, and you need to be free of things like being criminalized, as you said, which is also about writing these small fines and sometimes large fines to people in poor communities who have no way of paying them. And next thing you know, they're in prison because they can't pay a fine. And, that is extremely problematic. When you start this condition of imprisoning your people, as we've done in this country, mainly because of the war on drugs, to the point now that we imprison more people than any other country on the face of the planet, and not by a little, but by a lot, that is very, corrosive to community cohesion. It is very corrosive to healthy communities. And then when people return home, they can't get employed, they can't get jobs, and it just leads to other issues. And then the police are like, well, we have to be here because of all this crime and so on. No, if we stop harming our communities and create very healthy environments for them, we'd have very, very little need for the police. And as you said, we'll call you when we need you. And I had a conversation with someone the other day about these small fines and stopping people as police officers for equipment violations on your car, a tag light being out, a stoplight being out, a cracked windshield, and these things. you know, they can be handled. You know, if we think that these are unsafe conditions for people to be driving cars, you know what? Then have semi-annual or annual inspections of cars so that people would be required to get these things fixed. And if you think it's something that needs to be tended to or dealt with before a biannual inspection or annual inspection, okay, if a police officer sees someone with a tag light out or cracked windshield, then right on their computer in their car, enter the tag number, crack windshield, it goes off to the Motor Vehicle Administration, and immediately that person gets a notice in the mail saying, hey, it's been reported by Officer so-and-so, you have a cracked windshield, we're requiring you to get it fixed and inspect it within the next 30 days. You know, and then that police officer remains available for important calls of service, you know, where people might be hurting people and no longer, you know, stopping people, harassing people, and, you know, levying fines on people that they would have a problem paying money. Think about this, money to pay the fine, money that would be needed to get the windshield fixed. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your time. And I want, you said that you've written articles and have you written a book?
I have not. People keep telling me to do so, but I don't have time. I got work to do.
Well, tell people where they can get more information on the work you're trying to do.
Sure. Please go to our website, which is lawenforcementaction.org. That's lawenforcementaction.org. And if that's too much for you to type in, just do leap.cc. That's leap.cc.
Awesome. Well, Mr. Franklin, I really appreciate your time. And, you know, whoever you can talk to about Ross, and, you know, just educate people on the fact that he's not what everybody's painted him as, and that, you know, he's a victim of this system. And, you know, his case is really personal for me. It's the kind of thing I could have seen myself do. And, you know, there before the grace of God, that kind of thing. So
anything
you can do to help. But I really appreciate your time. And I think everybody who is listening to this is going to find it extremely refreshing to hear somebody with your background who actually did the job speaking about fixing everything that's wrong with it. So thank you very
much. Absolutely. Well, Matt, thank you very much for having me on. And I have been, and I certainly will continue to advocate for that young man. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
I want to thank you for tuning in to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Neil for coming on. I want to remind you about my books, Freedom Through Memedom, Kids Are Not All Right, available on Amazon, available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, for cryptocurrency. Be back at you in a couple days with another podcast. So take care. Bye.